So tonight I'd like to talk more on this theme of concentration. We've alluded to it and mentioned it here and there. Vance talked a little about the difference between concentration and mindfulness in one of the questions. And I want to go into a little more detail because it's such an important factor in our overall meditation and in the Buddha's Eightfold Path and teachings. Concentration has been around in human history for a long time. Go back as long as there is history, and there have been priests and priestesses and shamans who have used the power of concentration to develop some relationship to spirits or nature or altered states of consciousness to make healing possible. That's been going on as long as history has been around, as far as I can tell, in just about every culture on the face of the earth. And then in the Buddha's lifetime, which was about 2,500 years ago, as he was leaving home and starting to practice, and this is the phase we'll call the Bodhisattva. Normally when we talk about a Bodhisattva in our tradition, we're talking about this being Siddhartha Gautama before he became the Buddha, when he was journeying to become the Buddha. In the Mahayana tradition, there are lots of Bodhisattvas. And maybe you all are bodhisattvas. I don't know about that. But in the lifetime of our Buddha, he was the bodhisattva in recorded history and our canon. And when he set off from his home, I'm sorry, I have to fill in some of this history because there are mistakes going around. He was not the son of a king. He was not a prince. There were two kings in neighboring kingdoms, Magadha and Kosala, but his father was not those kings. His father was like a chieftain, the head of a clan, the head of a village. And so he grew up with wealth. The bodhisattva grew up with wealth. But he was not destined to become a king because the king already had sons. Kings already had sons. But he left his luxurious lifestyle and renounced and went off on his spiritual quest to try to come to the end of suffering. The first two teachers that we have any record of him taking teachings from taught him deep states of concentration. And these were formless attainments of nothingness and neither perception nor non-perception. So while he was in those practicing in those states, he was beyond the reach of suffering. They were temporary states of freedom, but he always had to come out. And then he once again faced the inevitability of dukkha, of aging, illness, death, and eventual rebirth. So even though he had developed strong states of concentration, and he was so good at it that his teachers asked him to teach with them, it wasn't what he was looking for. So thank goodness he moved on, the bodhisattva moved on, and then discovered for himself a true path to liberation, to what we could call perpetual liberation, unshakable deliverance of mind. So the bodhisattva set aside those strong concentration practices as inadequate, not quite what he was looking for, continued on his journey and found his way to the path of liberation that we have practiced and you have practiced today. But this factor of concentration is very central in the Buddha's teachings. So I want to talk about that centrality tonight, talk about what it is, what it means, how it's developed, what obstructs it, some of the deepening levels of concentration that are possible for us as practitioners. And so in reference to this centrality of concentration in many spiritual traditions, you see lots of cartoons kind of referencing it these days. And I think what that indicates is there's something archetypal in this experience of concentration. So some of the, you know, there are all these cartoons about the guru on the mountaintop. They're showing up all over the place. There's something archetypal they're tuning into. So one of the cartoons that I really liked, a seeker is climbing up this cliff And on a plateau at the edge of the cliff, probably it's in the Himalayas, right, is someone who's dressed up in sort of yogic garb, basically just in a loincloth. It's a male sitting in a lotus position, just with a loincloth. And the seeker comes over the top of the hill, sitting in front of the master, presumably. And the caption to the cartoon is, "If I knew the meaning of life, would I be sitting in this cave in my underpants?" So this I take to be on the wisdom end of the cartoons. But there's also something archetypal in the image of meditators. So for me, the archetype of concentration is someone, male or female, sitting still, eyes closed, wrapped up in a shawl. This personifies for me something about concentration. And what I love about sitting on a long retreat, as you all are doing, is that if I come into the hall early in the morning or late at night and it's pretty empty, there will almost always be somebody sitting like that. Sitting still, wrapped up in a shawl, embodying that archetype. And there are a few things I get from that archetype and from the images of you all when you're sitting like that. One is the quality of stillness. The body is unmoving, and there's a sense that the attention is indrawn. So there's a drawing in of the attention into the stillness and a sort of wrapped upness that the shawl symbolizes. But the wrapped upness is an inner wrapped upness also. And with that inner stillness, there's a sense of being withdrawn from the world and being in touch with some dimension of mind that's more satisfying than normal worldly activities. So that's what the image of concentration represents for me. And this is something that you all have been developing. You know, we've been in retreat now for 10 days. For some of you, 10 days might be the longest period of retreat that you've done, or maybe that you've done in a while, since we've basically been closed for most of 3 years. So this is already a substantial period of retreat, and I'm definitely feeling in the meetings that I have the factor of concentration developing for people. So this is happening for you already. But I was really struck. Many of you have been to Spirit Rock. There are a lot of people here from California. Many of you have been to Spirit Rock. And you know that there's a beautiful meditation hall perched up on the hill where the retreats happen. And then dormitories where people live when they're on those retreats. But that is a relatively recent development, and Spirit Rock was bought about 10 years before that meditation hall went up. So for the first 10 years, the field where the hall is and the residences was all open land. And if you look at the shape of it, as you're looking to the meditation hall from the road going up, on the right-hand side is a curve that faces the hillside that's going up to your left, and it kind of makes a natural amphitheater. And then there's a creek that runs by the meditation hall down the middle. So in one of the early years that Spirit Rock was there, we invited Thich Nhat Hanh to come and teach. And we set up a big platform on the right-hand side for him to sit on. And then the amphitheater, the natural amphitheater, the slope of the hillside was filled with like 1,000 meditators. So he came to teach a day long. And of course, maybe the Buddha could speak to 500 people at once and they'd all get enlightened. But today, we needed amplifiers. So we set up big speakers on towers. Thay was on a big platform and everybody could see him due to the shape of the amphitheater. And he started speaking and teaching meditation. And as I was sitting in the crowd, what I felt was happening is that he was casting a spell of samadhi over the whole crowd. He just emanated stillness. And as you tuned into him, both his words and his body language, he communicated that stillness to 1,000 people. So it was like this layer of samadhi just settled over the whole crowd. You could feel it. It was tangible. And then in a break, he took everybody for a walking meditation to the other end of the property. So there's still this photo at Spirit Rock of Thay leading this troop of, must be 500 meditators, walking behind him, going up to the other end of the property, and then walking back. It was really a beautiful day and a beautiful manifestation of the depth of meditation. Something contagious about it. Concentration comes up in so many of the Buddhist teachings. It is the last factor in the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path is somewhat sequential. So in a way, it is building to this factor of concentration. It follows mindfulness. So if you think of it as a sequential deepening, concentration is after mindfulness in the sequence. So today in the media, there is all sorts of emphasis on mindfulness. You know, we've got a magazine now. Mindfulness. You've really made it when you've got a magazine. So all the attention and most of the research is on mindfulness. You know, there's so many academic studies now. You know, the psychological benefits of mindfulness, the health benefits, the social benefits, and so forth. But in the galaxy of the Buddhist teachings and the Eightfold Path, concentration is the brighter star. It's one step further than mindfulness along the path. So I would say, let's wait for the magazine called Concentration. But the thing is, that largely depends on people practicing mindfulness long enough to reach it, which takes some time. You've probably noticed that. It takes time for concentration to develop. And as I say, just in the last days, I've been feeling in the practice meetings the evidence of its developing in a lot of you that I've spoken to. But this is something that takes time. And then when we look on our practice over many years, concentration will continue to deepen, and that also takes time. It takes time really to grow concentration into great strength. So one of the things that Vance talked about in answering the question on concentration and mindfulness was a translation of the word samadhi, which is the Pali that we translate as concentration. And Vance said it's not a very good translation, and I agree with that. It misses the nuances, or it brings in its own nuances which aren't accurate. So in English, concentration refers to an exclusive focus of attention, right? It's like, I'm trying to do my homework. Don't distract me with that music. Although, how many students actually say that? Please turn up the music. Samadhi does not have that connotation of an exclusive focus. It can, but it doesn't have to. Samadhi isn't about a focus of attention, either narrow or wide. Samadhi is about the quality of mind. Vance talked about a possible synonym being this factor of stability. That's a good way to think about concentration. When concentration arrives, the mind feels stable. One of the definitions that you find in the discourses is, in Pali, the term is chittasa ekagata. And this means unification of mind. Chittasa is of the mind. Ekagata means unification or oneness, oneness of the mind. This is, I think, a very nice way to think of what concentration, of what samadhi really means. The mind becomes unified. How is our mind usually in daily life? Often distracted. Running off to past, running off to future, getting involved in analyzing, getting involved in remembrance. not unified. But when the mind becomes unified, something really powerful happens. This is from Wordsworth. The world is too much with us. Late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. That distractedness wastes our powers. When the mind's whole energy is brought back together in that unification, the mind's natural power is returned to it. And so we find when the mind comes back together, it becomes strong, it becomes stable, it becomes steady, and it becomes penetrating. So this is really what's involved in the term samadhi. Much more than just a narrow exclusive focus, it's the mind coming back into itself. Now it is concentrated in a sense. It's sort of the same way frozen orange juice is concentrated. Right? Frozen orange juice means that all the non-essential stuff has been squeezed out. And what remains is quite powerful. It's concentrated. That's the way the mind becomes. When it gets concentrated, it's strong. And that's what we're developing. So one of the first things that happens is with that stability of mind, we start to feel peace. And this is a wonderful development. When I came upon this in my early months of meditation, of retreat meditation, I thought, how come nobody ever told me about this peace being possible? Because I hadn't known it in my daily life. My mind was so busy. I was trained to think. I went through university, probably. A lot of you had a similar experience. Going through university, we're trained to think. And I thought that was a solution to all my problems. So I kept thinking. And only through meditation could I find that settledness that brought a degree of peace. So I'm sure some of you have noticed and you've been reporting that when the mind acquires this kind of stability, thoughts are not so problematic. Thoughts arise, but due to the stability, they just pass away. There's enough presence. We don't grab after them, and they don't actually disturb this inner peace that has been growing. And then we're not so buffeted by the changing weather within. So it's really important that we start to recognize the presence of concentration in our direct experience, because as we recognize it, we find our way back to it more easily. It's like, okay, this is a possibility. We start to learn how it arose. This is part of the fourth foundation that someone will talk about not too long. This is the path to bringing into existence that factor of concentration, which is one of the seven factors of enlightenment. So we start to see that one of the characteristics is it's stable. And what's stable? Our present moment attention. Our attention is stable in the present moment when the mind becomes concentrated. And that means that we can be with a number of moments of experience in a row with mindfulness. That's one of the great benefits. So we start to notice when it's present. The Buddha recommended this in the third foundation. The practitioner understands concentrated mind as concentrated mind and unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated mind. So we start to recognize it and how it arose, and also we'll see how it passes. It's not permanent. When I first came upon it, I had an idea that meditation was like a linear development. And now that I'd reached this state of concentration, it was going to last. And I thought, wow, my life will be fantastic when I go back with this state of concentration. Nothing's going to upset me. I'm going to get great jobs and find a great relationship because I'm going to be such a stable guy. it didn't last past the next sitting. So concentration is impermanent. It will arise. It will pass away. Don't worry. Once you've learned the pathway to it, you can develop it again. So let's talk about why we would like to develop samadhi. I've already talked about part of it. First, it makes us calm. And that's a wonderful thing in and of itself. There is, with peace, comes the feeling of well-being and ease. And I think this is what so many of us have looked for in meditation. Whether in the secular version through mindfulness-based stress reduction, or in this intensive version here on retreat, we're looking for a degree of peace of mind. And as it develops, it's very satisfying. You know, I don't know how one can live a happy life, truly, without some access to this kind of peace of mind. For me, it's just become a foundation, kind of a baseline, that things may come along and disturb, but the mind knows how to find its way back there. And so there's a real sense of protection and refuge in that discovery, and a source of happiness. The Dalai Lama says, inner peace is the key. If you have inner peace, the external problems do not affect your deep sense of peace and tranquility. Samadhi, collectedness, is a big part of this. So, first it makes us calm, and that brings a significant measure of happiness. And second, it sets us free, if we continue to develop it in the direction of insight. So, when the mind is stirred up, it can't see very clearly. We're thrown all kinds of ways by the forces of greed, aversion, and delusion. And we can't really see so clearly the way things are. As the mind settles, now we can start to see clearly. From that base of peace, we can see things more the way they are. This is from a discourse of the Buddha. The purpose and benefit of concentration is the knowledge and vision of things as they are. I'm going to read that again because it's really important. The purpose and benefit of concentration is the knowledge and vision of things as they are. That is, when the mind settles, we can see things truly. We can see things accurately. We can see things the way they are. And what's the purpose of seeing things as they are? That's what leads to liberation. So the same discourse goes on to explain how this seeing leads to liberation. So concentration is a really key ingredient on the path to liberation, key ingredient for insight. So it's a little bit like, you know, suppose you're on a merry-go-round, right? You've hopped on one of those painted horses, and you're going round and round and round. It's a lot of fun. But a friend of yours walks up to the side of the merry-go-round and holds up a newspaper. And you're spinning by, and you think, well, it must be important because my friend's holding it up. What does it say? Can't read it. And the merry-go-round starts to slow down. You come to rest in front of your friend, and you can read the headlines. Everything changes. If you hold on, you suffer. Letting go is freeing. Oh, I got it. So that's what collectedness lets us see. We can read those headlines about the way things are in this life. So, how does concentration develop? Again, as a few people have said, one of the key things that we're going to say again and again, in Vance's talk, it was the second job of the yogi, is to build in continuity of mindfulness. It is from continuity of moments of mindfulness that concentration develops. When I say continuity, I don't want you to think that it's like absolutely continuous, like one string going on and on, but rather it's like there's a moment here and then we get lost, and then there's a moment here and maybe we get lost, and there's a moment here and we get lost. That's okay. You know, later there will be a moment here and a moment here and a moment here and a moment here. Then we get lost. And then we go back to it and build it up here and build up here, build up here. So continuity doesn't mean absolutely continuous. It just means we put it in more and more frequently. Joseph Goldstein, loves to teach and talk about the noting practice. And one of his metrics for you to use to gauge how your noting practice is going is what he calls NPMs. How many notes per minute are coming through? And that means a note is a moment of mindfulness, right? How many moments of mindfulness per minute are coming through? This may be a little too quantitative for some of you. Being a math minor in college, I love it, but you don't have to. So this is one way to think about continuity. It's a more accurate term would be frequency. The frequency of moments of mindfulness. So this is why mindfulness precedes concentration in the Eightfold Path. We put in right effort to develop right mindfulness, and right mindfulness is what develops right concentration. By and large, we can't jump from right effort to right concentration. That's not within our power for most of us. Someone like Deepa Ma, yes. Someone like you and me, not yet. So we have to go through mindfulness to get to right concentration. So you've been concentrated for a period and it falls away. What often happens? Oh, I want it back. And if we try directly for concentration, I want to reproduce that feeling of concentration, leads to striving. Because we can't regenerate that concentration. We have to go through the process of mindfulness. And not mindfulness with forcing and over-efforting, but a calm, relaxed interest in the present moment. That will lead onward to concentration. So basically, it's about doing one thing at a time and giving it your full attention. The unification of mind means give it your full attention in this moment. So a lot of you probably have heard of this Korean Zen master who used to teach, founded a center in Providence, Rhode Island. His name was Sonsonim. He was very famous in Korea, and when he came here, nobody knew him. He didn't have a community, he didn't have a sangha. He went to work repairing machines in a laundromat to support himself while he established Korean Zen meditation in this country. But he was a fantastic teacher and drew lots of students and became quite famous. He came to IMS one year at the end of a 3-month course. I've never heard so much laughter in the hall as when Sonsonim was speaking. He was really an interesting and creative teacher. So one of his ways of encouraging practice, he told people, when you sit, just sit. And when you eat, just eat. So this is like doing one thing at a time. But he was living in community with some of his students. They do that in the Zen world. And one of his students said, but Sonsonim, I've seen you at breakfast and you're sitting and eating at the same time. Not at a loss for words, he replied, when you sit and eat, just sit and eat. But do it wholly, do it wholeheartedly. So, it develops from sustained moments of mindfulness. There's this 5th century meditation text from Sri Lanka called the Visuddhimagga. It is one of the key ancient texts in our lineage, in the Theravadan lineage. It was compiled by a monk named Buddhaghosa. And it's still used today as a basis for teaching meditation. So in the Visuddhimagga, which means path of purification, there are 40 different meditations recommended for developing strong concentration. And they include things like corpses, casinas, which, you know, hardly any of us have heard of. They're like colored discs or just color or representations of the elements that one focuses attention on. Recollections about death, about Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And then the last two are ones that are much more common in our community today, mindfulness of breathing and the Brahmaviharas. So any of these can be used as focuses to develop strong samadhi. Usually, these kinds of practices are lumped in a category called samatha practices. Samatha, usually translated as tranquility. Specific practices are offered many times to develop the quality of tranquility and at the same time develop concentration or samadhi. And this is samatha practices are contrasted with the other side, which is vipassana. And that's really what we're engaged with here, insight practices. So we have practices of samatha, practices for vipassana. In the Buddha's teachings, he didn't distinguish between those two. He talked about the development both of tranquility and insight, but he didn't say, do this to develop tranquility and do this to develop insight. More the flavor you get from the Buddha's teachings at the time is that when you practice mindfulness, you will develop both samatha and vipassana. You will develop both calm and insight. So that's the way we tend to hold it. Yet, it is true that some practices will emphasize one more strongly than another. So, for people who really want to pursue the path of tranquility, we do recommend at times in retreat practices like mindfulness of breathing or practices of the Brahmaviharas. So this is something that sometimes goes on in these 6-week or 3-month retreats. People will choose to focus on a samatha practice for a period of time. It's something that you don't decide on the spur of the moment. Here, you really need to work it out with your teacher ahead of time if that's something you want to do. And that means your teacher needs to know your overall practice by that point. So it's not something that we do a lot, but we occasionally do. So the Buddha said this very interesting thing. The samatha and vipassana have different purposes. Samatha is for the abandoning of lust. And that's in the broadest possible sense, all forms of desire. In other words, the development of strong tranquility itself can offset desire because there's so much contentment in the present moment. The mind is not pulled outside. Samatha is for the abandoning of lust. Vipassana is for the abandoning of ignorance. Ignorance is the fundamental blindness that keeps us trapped in samsara. When we cut to the root of ignorance and truly abandon it, then the heart and mind are truly free. Heart and mind are truly free, and it's possible then to abandon the cycles of samsara, samsaric existence. And just speaking again in praise of samatha, there's this very beautiful passage, one of the most beautiful passages in the Pali Canon, which I want to come back to in a later talk, where the Buddha talks about more or less a glide path into nibbana, into the realization of the unconditioned or enlightenment. And one of the first steps in the glide path is the stilling of all mental formations. And the Pali is sabba sankhara samato. Sabba sankhara samato. The last word means the stilling, it's samatha. Sabba means all, sankhara means mental formations, samato. All mental formations go to stillness. This is the entryway into the realization of nibbana. And so based on that, I sort of wonder if a better translation for samatha is stillness. It has a little deeper ring than tranquility. So you might like to think of that. Stillness meditation. That's a very appealing notion for me. Okay, so we've talked about samadhi as the unification of mind. Really, a synonym is this ekagata. It's included as a definition at one point. Ekagata. But ekagata has often been translated in this tradition as one-pointed. You can kind of see the similarity, right? Unification of mind or one-pointed. Which do you like better? So I sort of like unification of mind, but this concept of one-pointed also works. It also applies. And what it kind of implies is one point of focus, like the breath. So when I was practicing with Pātlok Sayadaw, this is definitely what we were practicing. The one point of focus was right underneath the nose, around the upper lip. That was the only point I was meant to be at all day long. And that is a powerful practice. As a number of people here who have practiced it will testify also. Very powerful practice and very useful. I learned a lot from Sayadaw. But it's not the only way that concentration gets developed. This single focus is one way. It features a lot in our tradition, but it's not the only way. Concentration can also be developed on changing objects. And that's what the Mahasi Sayadaw instructions do so brilliantly. We've already started to expand, right? We started with an anchor. So you're focusing on sounds, or body, or breath. And that was, in a way, a form of one-pointedness. We're restricting the attention. We're honing in on something. But then we started to open up, you know, body sensations, emotions, thoughts, sounds. We'll keep opening. Thoughts, I think I said that. We'll keep opening to more potential places to focus. So in the Mahasi system, as this opens up, we may start connecting with the breath, but we allow the attention then to go to anything else that draws it. And we become mindful there. So we are still developing mindfulness moment after moment, but with different objects. And that's what you've been doing already as you've moved through these instructions. The mindfulness has been developing and the concentration has been developing. As long as there are still these moments of mindfulness, even if the objects are changing, the concentration will grow. Concentration will build. And this is based on a concept that's called Kanika Samadhi. Kanika means momentary. So there's a momentary focusing, connection with each new object. And then that drops and it moves to the next. And then a focusing on the new one. So the samadhi is building up moment by moment on changing objects. And it works very well in this Mahasi Sayadaw system. It can take one to very deep levels of concentration. So it really works very well. You'll see it as it unfolds for you. And it's another very effective way to develop that's not just single-pointed. But it unifies the mind by bringing fullness of attention moment after moment. Now there's one other approach to ekagata that I want to bring through. Ajahn Sumedho, who is a wonderful teacher in the Thai forest lineage, the first Western disciple of Ajahn Chah, and then established Chithurst Monastery in England and Amaravati Monastery in England, of which there are now many branch monasteries and nunneries throughout North America and Europe and Australia. Really wonderful monk and teacher. Ajahn Sumedho likes to translate ekagata as the one point that includes everything. So it's not like this tiny, you know, area underneath the nose. What's the one point that includes everything? How about the present moment? So this really opens up from a narrow focus to potentially a really wide focus. How wide is the present moment? How wide is your consciousness? It's wide. And that's all in the present moment. So I love this approach also to the significance of ekagata. If the mind is fully in the present moment, however wide the focus, concentration will develop. So these are three different approaches to this unification of mind. So we will all continue to develop this factor as we continue with the retreat. It's really unavoidable. As long as you stay developing the mindfulness, the concentration will grow from it. And there is a wide range of abilities of individuals with concentration, much more so than with mindfulness. You know, if we ask all of you to be mindful for a moment, I really feel each of you will get there. In that moment, mindfulness will be there. No problem for anyone here. Mindfulness will be there. If we ask each of you to become strongly concentrated by tomorrow, the results will not be uniform. So concentration is an innate strength for some people. It's a little bit like athletic ability. I tend to limit myself to one sport because otherwise I get too distracted. And the sport that I really love is tennis because I've played it for a long time and I love to watch people play it well. So in the world of tennis, I've really loved watching Roger Federer and Serena Williams because they have this natural athletic ability, you know, that involves power and strength and agility and speed and hand-eye coordination and all of that. They are so fun to watch. Unfortunately, they're both retiring. But. So sad. But they've been beautiful to watch. They have abilities that I could never, ever have reached because they came in with that athletic potential. Concentration works a little bit like that. Some people come in with a real power for concentration. I was not one of those people. So I remember being on a staff retreat here in, I think it was like 1979. The staff here was, at that time, Carol and I were on together. I think we were 11 people in total running this facility. Now the staff is about 50, but we have the Forest Refuge also. I don't know if we actually worked harder or we just ended up not doing as well. But anyway, there were 11 of us, and in the winter we would have a week's retreat together. So the center would close down and we'd be on retreat together. So we were 4 or 5 days into the retreat, and we were sitting in this upper walking room. We closed off this to save the heat. We were sitting in the upper walking room, and I was sitting. And sometime through a sitting, I opened my eyes for some reason. And I looked at one of my friends who was sitting next to me, another staff person whom I'd gotten to know over the past year. And she was sitting kind of like, not like making it up. She was in some other space. And I had never gotten to that space before. And I just thought, she's got something I don't got. But I just realized that wasn't in my blood or whatever. So I was happy for her, but I wasn't there. You may have heard stories about Deepa Ma. She had that. So on one of her first retreats, it might have been her very first retreat, I'm not sure, she went deep very quickly. And she was walking up to the meditation hall, which was at the top of a number of stairs, and all of a sudden she couldn't take another step. She couldn't move forward, and she didn't know why. But she just stood there, like 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And then finally she looked down. A dog had gotten a hold of her ankle, and she hadn't felt it. She was so wrapped up in her inner experience, she didn't know that a dog had bit her ankle. And finally it let go, and she could continue walking. But she was so absorbed. There's a Thai teacher named Ajahn Jomnian who used to come out and teach at Spirit Rock. And in his early years, his father had been a monk at one point and taught him meditation when he was young, when Jomnian was young. Father had taught him meditation. At one point, Ajahn Jomnian, who didn't really like to meditate, was carrying out his father's orders, and he went into a deep state of absorption. And the father said, okay, you can come back now. Didn't return. He said, come back now. He just stayed meditating. His mother would come over. Darling, it's time for dinner. You know, please come. Didn't budge. This went on for a day. And he showed no signs of wanting to leave his meditative state. It was probably quite comfy in there. And finally, his mother used her, you know, sweetest maternal voice and pleaded with him. Please, darling, come back. We are missing you so much. And then he came out. But his father realized at that point he had a meditation prodigy on his hands. So as he grew up, he was trained in both Buddhist practices, both samatha and vipassana, and also in a shamanic tradition in his village. So he learned healing arts through his shamanic training. And when he was teaching at Spirit Rock, he would sit up on the stage, and you wouldn't see this most of the time. He was wrapped up in his monk's robes. But in the middle of a teaching once at Spirit Rock, he had his translator point out a woman in the audience and say to her, is your stomach upset now? Because he had psychic powers. And the woman said, well, yes. You know, she's a little surprised. Yes, as a matter of fact, it is. And then he opened his robe, and underneath he had this big vest that was full of hundreds of pockets and pouches and zippers and clothespins and so on. And in that, there were, you know, amulets and statues and medicines and pills and lotions and potions. And so he took this bottle out, little bottle of white fluid, and said to the translator, have her drink this. That will help her stomach. So she did. I don't know what happened after that. She didn't report back to us. But he had very strong powers of concentration. So, some people have it in spades, others of us don't. I did not. But because of that, I realized that it was something I needed to develop. So I worked really hard to develop concentration. And what I did, so it happened mostly in the 90s. I would come here in the fall to sit 6 weeks, and I would do samatha practice with the Brahmaviharas. And doing that a number of times in a row, and then practicing also with Pa'ok Sayadaw for about 2.5 months, my concentration got better. It's still not great, but it's a lot better. And I'm very grateful for the time that I spent in doing those periods of samatha practice, because I think it changed the cells in my body. I think the relaxation and ease that I discovered, the inner peace that I discovered through that, changed my body on a cellular level. And I still feel the benefits of it today. What blocks samatha development? Well, I think it's pretty obvious, right? Getting lost in thought. When we're no longer developing mindfulness, moment after moment, we're losing the accumulation of power that mindfulness provides. So as we get lost in thought, we are not developing more concentration. That movement has been short-circuited. So, the main thing, and it's why we stress it, is the continuity of mindfulness throughout the day. Throughout the day. It's the main thing that will develop, and things that obstruct it, like a lot of thinking, thought trains. Not just one thought, thought trains will obstruct it. The other thing, of course, is the hindrances. When Monica talked about the 5 hindrances that we work with, I'm sure you got the clear message that these obstruct mindfulness until we learn how to work with them. We can develop mindfulness with the hindrances if we look at the hindrance and not the object that it's pointing to. But But if we're captivated by the object it's pointing to, we lose the development of mindfulness. So the hindrances also obstruct the deepening of concentration. Now, I just want to say one more thing about the development, the positive development of concentration, and that is in the direction of jhanas. So you all have, most of you probably have heard of these states called jhanas. They are states of strong concentration, often described as absorptions, because the mind tends to get collected within itself, folded in within itself. And it's the territory the Buddha was exploring with his, the Buddha-to-be exploring with his first teachers. But we start at a lower level than the states that he described. It is the outcome of sustained development of concentration for many people. It is possible, it is achievable in this day and age for some people. So the entry point into it is looking at these things called the five jhanic factors. The entry point to the jhanas, there are four of them. The entry point is the first of them, then they get successively deeper. But the first one is made up of five factors of mind. And we work toward it by developing what we can of these factors of mind, which then influence the growth of the other factors of mind. So there are these five factors of mind that we want to kind of monitor if we're interested in developing concentration to the level of jhana. We're not teaching jhana in this retreat, but I want you to know about it, and you can think about maybe on a future retreat if that's something you'd want to do. So the five jhanic factors, I'm going to say them in Pali, and then I'll explain them. Vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata. So ekagata, we've already talked about unification of mind. Piti means rapture. You've probably heard about it from the seven factors of enlightenment. Sukha means pleasure. You may have heard about it from different sources. But I want to talk tonight about vitaka vichara. In the early translations, these were translated as initial thought and sustained thought. What does initial thought have to do with jhana? What does sustained thought have to do with jhana? Not very much. These are not about thinking. So I don't think these are good translations. So the way that it's been taught to me is that vitaka means aiming for or connecting with the object of meditation. So aiming or connecting. So you can think about this in relation to the breath. If you sit down to become mindful of breath, what do? You direct your attention to the sensation of breathing. That's vitaka. Once you land there, then vichara comes in. Vichara means sustaining your attention with that experience for a little while. Half a breath is enough. So you connect with the breath, and then you sustain there. Half a breath or a breath is enough. That's what gets the concentration engine going. So these two factors, vitaka and vichara, you can apply over and over and over and over in your mindfulness. And it's helpful to start tuning into them. You aim for something, connect, and then you sustain it or you rub it. You rub it with your attention. So you have the sense you get close to the breath through aiming, and then you rub it. You rub that sensation by sustaining. By the rubbing, you get really a feeling for what's there. You see its individual characteristics, rough or smooth or long or short, and you also see its universal characteristics. It's impermanent. If you try to hold on, it's unsatisfactory. There's nobody there doing the breathing. So aiming and rubbing is something we can do again and again with any of our focuses. Okay, so if you're interested in increasing the development of concentration here, what can you do? What specific steps can you take? And there are a number. So this is going to be the last part of this talk. I'm just going to run through a bunch of things. I'm not going to comment on them much. You can work with them or ignore them as you like. But here are some tips. First, you can take a primary focus on the breath. You can continue with that as a primary object, even as other objects come in when the attention is drawn. By staying with the breath as a primary focus, you're going to be building that stability more and more and more. If you use noting or counting with it, it will heighten that continuity of mindfulness. Counting is not just for beginners. When I was practicing mindfulness of breathing with Paok Sayadaw, he instructed me to use counting, and I used it in virtually every sitting for 2.5 months when I was practicing with him. Even if you're not with the breath as a primary focus, the continuity of noting will be very helpful for developing many moments of mindfulness. When you're using noting regularly, you really know when you're with mindfulness and you really know when you're not, because the notes have stopped. So the noting practice is very, very helpful for sustaining the continuity of mindfulness. Then in all the activities of the day, see if you can stretch out the continuity of mindfulness. In eating, in walking around, moving around your room, taking a shower, doing your service meditation, whatever, see what can sustain the continuity of mindfulness there. The fourth, use walking periods for formal walking. There will be more moments of mindfulness, I will wager, in a period of formal walking than in a period of walking the loop. I'm just guessing. But there probably will. So, I don't know to what extent everyone is engaging formal walking in your daily schedule. If you're not yet, I really encourage you to try a period, morning or afternoon, where you do a sitting, move immediately to a formal walking, and back into a sitting. Just that degree of continuity, if you haven't been doing it so far, will make a notable difference. Fifth, slowing down in all your movements. So when you're moving around the building, between the meditation hall and your room, between your room and the dining room, when you finished a meal and you're coming back into the meditation hall, walk slowly, move slowly. One meditation master said, yogis should act like old persons. Act like you're already a little decrepit, even if you're not. And that will slow you down and bring in more mindfulness. Guarding the sense doors. Now, sometimes people think guarding the sense doors means we shut them off. You know, I should just keep my eyes down and not look anywhere else, and the less sense contact I have, the better, and it's better if I don't see or hear or smell or taste, and that'll keep me more protected. That's not the meaning the Buddha put on guarding the sense doors. It's fine to be open. What guarding the sense doors means is being very careful when you do see or hear or smell or taste. Don't let the mind proliferate off that. Don't get caught up in reactive formations. Judging each other, desiring each other, craving more of that food. Watch what happens on the basis of sense contact closely. Guard it that way. It's not that you can't look. Don't pursue what comes out of it. Let it go. And the last thing to say is, to the extent that you are able to, without pushing too hard or striving too hard, to extend your hours of formal practice in a day, that will definitely help in the development of the momentum of concentration. So when I would sit in retreats here, the 3-month course and 6 weeks and so on, I would take the schedule from 5 in the morning till 9:30 at night as my starting point. And when it said sit, I sat. When it said walk, I walked. And then I would, as the retreat went on, I would add on to that. And normally I found that 6 hours of sleep a night was fine for me. Sometimes I would reduce it further. But, you know, 6 hours was kind of a good cruising level for me. And the rest of the day I was just doing sitting and walking. Now, this works well for some people and not for everybody. So if you are young and strong and healthy, or you are older and strong and healthy, and I mean both mentally and physically really well, really well, then you're in a position to try this. If you are suffering from bodily limitations, from ill health, from aging joints, from sore knees, if there's a lot going on internally with emotions and there's past trauma or history of difficulty, this might not be the right fit. But strong, healthy, interested, keen, eager can be really useful. Talk with your teacher to see what makes sense for you. But it can be really, really helpful. I apologize for going on, but I have one more quote. So I'm going to close with this quotation from the Buddha. When my concentrated mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, and steady, I directed it to the knowledge of the destruction of the taints. I directly knew as it actually is. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. When I knew and saw thus, my mind was liberated from the taints. I directly knew. Birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. So let's just sit for a moment, please. When I knew and saw thus, my mind was liberated from the taints. I directly knew. Birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. Thank you for your attention. We have about 25 minutes for walking now, and then someone will cheer you up at the end of the day.